Mystery Club. Chapter 81. Would you like a walnut? Asks Ibrahim. Bernard Cottle looks at him and then down at the open bag of walnuts he is being offered. No, thank you. Ibrahim withdraws the bag. Very low carb, walnuts. In moderation, nuts are very healthy. But not cashews, cashews are an exception. Am I disturbing you, Bernard? No, no, says Bernard. Just enjoying the view, asks Ibrahim. He can sense that Bernard feels uncomfortable sharing his bench. Just taking the weight off, says Bernard. What a place to be buried, says Ibrahim. Wouldn't you think? If one has to be buried, says Bernard. Sadly, it comes to the best of us, doesn't it? However many walnuts we might eat. I mean no offense by this, but I'm very happy to sit in silence, says Bernard. That's not unreasonable, says Ibrahim, nodding. He eats a piece of walnut. The two men sit, taking in the view. Ibrahim turns, and sees Ron walking up the path, trying to hide his limp. He has a stick, but he won't use it. Well, this is nice, says Ibrahim. Here comes Ron. Bernard looks, there is the slightest pursing of the lips. Ron reaches the bench. He sits the other side of Bernard. Afternoon, gents, says Ron. Good afternoon, Ron, says Ibrahim. So, Bernard, old son, says Ron. You keeping guard? Bernard looks at Ron. Keeping guard. Of the graveyard. Sitting here like a gnome, none shall pass, all that. What's up? Bernard wants to be left in silence, Ron, says Ibrahim. That's what he tells me. Fat chance of that with me around, says Ron. So come on, mate. What are you hiding up here? Hiding, asks Bernard. I don't buy all this grief stuff, son. We all miss our wives, with the greatest respect. Something else is going on here. I think grief affects people in different ways, Ron, says Ibrahim. Bernard's behavior is not unusual. I don't know, Ib, says Ron, shaking his head and looking out over the hills. Geezer gets killed the other day, when all he wanted to do was dig up the graveyard. Bernard sits here by that same graveyard all day, every day. That changes things for me. Is that what's happening here? Asks Bernard, voice calm and level, refusing to look at Ron. You're talking to me about the murder. That's what's happening, Bernard. Yeah, says Ron. Someone down there injected the guy and killed him. We all had our hands on him, remember? Any one of us could have done it. We simply need to eliminate some people from our inquiries, says Ibrahim. Maybe you had a good reason, says Ron. Is there ever a good reason to murder someone, Ron? Asks Bernard. Ron shrugs. Maybe you've got something hidden up there in the graveyard. You a diabetic? Good with a needle. We all are, Ron, says Bernard. Where were you in the 70s, mate? Were you local? That's a peculiar question, Ron, says Bernard. If you don't mind me saying. All the same, were you, says Ron. We're just exploring avenues, says Ibrahim. We're asking everyone. Bernard turns to Ibrahim. Is this the game? Good cop, nasty cop. Ibrahim considers this. Well, yes, that is the idea. Psychologically, it is often very effective. I have a book you could read if you are interested. Bernard lets out a long breath and turns to Ron. Ron, you met my wife. You met Asima. Ron nods. And you were nothing but kind to her. She liked you. Well, I liked her, Bernard. You had a good one there. Everyone liked her, Ron, says Bernard. And yet you still ask me why I sit here? It's nothing to do with the graveyard and it's nothing to do with needles. Or where I lived 50 years ago. I'm just an old man who misses his wife. So spare me. Bernard stands. Gentlemen, you have spoiled my morning. Shame on you both. Ibrahim looks up at Bernard. Bernard, I don't believe you, I'm afraid. I want to, but I don't. You have a story you are desperate to tell. So, any time you want to talk, you know where to find me. Bernard smiles and shakes his head. Talk. To you. Ibrahim nods. Yes, talk to me, Bernard. Or to Ron. Whatever has happened, the worst thing you could do is to stay silent. Bernard tucks his paper under his arm. With respect, Ibrahim, Ron, you have no idea what the worst thing I could do is. And with that, Bernard starts a slow walk down the hill. Chapter 82. Joyce, well, that was jolly good fun. For starters, I had never been to Folkestone. Peter Ward is Bobby Tanner's name now, but we are sworn to secrecy. He owns a florist. I suppose I have two things to write about then. Why was Peter Ward a florist? And, florist or not, who did he think killed Tony Curran? I might write about Bernard too, but I will leave that to the end, because I want to think about it while I write the rest. Peter Ward, I will call him Peter, left Fairhaven shortly after his brother died, for reasons you can imagine. He got himself a new passport. It's easily done if you listen to Elizabeth and Peter, but I wouldn't know how to go about it, would you? He ended up in Amsterdam, doing odd jobs. Not odd jobs as we would think about them, like clearing your gutters or painting a fence, but taking cocaine across the channel on ferries. Or, I suppose, threatening people. You could see that in him, underneath everything. He fell in with a gang from Liverpool. He wouldn't tell us the name, as if I would have any sway if he had. Their ruse was to smuggle drugs in the backs of those big flour lorries you see coming over from Holland and Belgium. That was their angle. At first, Peter would do the loading. A driver would be paid such and such to stop his lorry in a lay-by in Belgium, and Peter and a few cronies would hop in the back and stash what they could, where they could. Over the lorry would go, another stop in Kent and Bob's your uncle. These lorries were back and forth all the time. It's a daily schedule, isn't it? Has to be, because of fresh flowers. So it was perfect. They just had the odd driver here and there and that's how it worked at first. Until the penny dropped and they bought one of the nurseries. The business ran as usual, but Peter was on hand to inspect every shipment as it went out, and to add that little special something to each one. So now they had three lorries a day traveling through Zeebrugge and they could do what they liked with them. Clever, really. Peter would spend all his time at the nursery, and the young lad who ran it was paid to turn a blind eye. They'd play cards and chat and whatever else you do all day in Belgium. Off subject for a minute, but there was a notice pinned up the other day about a trip to Bruges and I thought of signing up. Joanna went a few years ago and her verdict was, it's too twee, Mum, but you would love it, so I might take the plunge. Would Elizabeth like it? That's by the by, because here's what happened next. There was an error, no one knows how or why, or at least Peter doesn't, but the upshot was that a small florist's shop in Gillingham accidentally took delivery of 2 kilograms of cocaine alongside their begonias and promptly reported it to the police. The police, who are no fools at times, didn't rush straight in and arrest the driver, they followed him instead and saw where he headed and what was what. There was a whole team on it eventually, and one by one they worked out who was doing what and arrested everyone they could. The way Peter told it, he and the young lad running the nursery had seen the police coming a mile off. Belgium is as flat as Holland, says Peter, and they hid in a field of sunflowers for 6 hours as the police stripped the place bare. In Amsterdam, one of the Liverpudlians was killed by a Serbian shortly afterwards and that was that. You can see where it's going, I'm sure. Peter had never really risen through the ranks, he wasn't really the type, but he'd made a bit of money and he had learned an awful lot about flowers. And he saw them at their most beautiful, of course. He described the colors and so on and got quite lyrical. Elizabeth had to hurry him along eventually. So, now, every day, one of those big lorries pulls up in Pearson Street and Peter gets in the back, like he always used to, but this time he just unloads his flowers and carries them into his shop. And the lorry continues on its rounds and heads back to Belgium, to the nursery run by the young lad he'd played cards with and hidden in a sunflower field with. So that's a nice story. I bet the Liverpud Lions and the Serbians are still shooting each other left, right, and center in Amsterdam, but Peter has his beautiful shop, in that lovely street, where everybody knows his name. Or doesn't know his name, but you take my point. And the benefit of going straight was that no one has ever come looking for him, no one has ever arrested him and taken a closer look at that passport, so Peter Ward had left his past behind and found some peace, which is not easy to do. Just to satisfy Elizabeth's curiosity, Peter took her to the flour mill and showed her the CCTV from the day Tony Curran was murdered. There he was, Peter, I mean, plain to see, behind the till. Which I think rules him out. He is sure that Turkish Johnny is our man. Tony had betrayed him to the police and Johnny had stolen from Tony in turn. That would do it, I suppose. Elizabeth and I talked about it on the train. And we had half an hour at Ashford International, where, believe it or not, there are no shops. Perhaps there are shops beyond passport control? There must be, surely. So that's Bobby Tanner. Time for bed, Joyce. I wonder what Ron and Ibrahim were up to today? I know I was going to say something about Bernard, but it hasn't really formulated, so I won't. I bought Bernard some free sais from Peter Ward's shop. I wanted to buy something but I couldn't think who to buy them for and I thought perhaps Bernard would like them. Do women give men flowers? Not where I'm from, but perhaps that's not where I am anymore. So they're in the sink, and I will take them over tomorrow morning. Bernard would like Bruges. Don't you think? Chapter 83. The path is uneven, but by shining a torch at the ground he is able to make his way up to the allotments without drawing attention to himself. It is late, and everyone will be asleep, but why take a risk? He reaches the shed. There is a padlock, but it's a cheap one and his wife's hatpin soon springs it open. The shed is shared by all the residents who have an allotment at Cooper's Chase. A select band. There are a couple of folding chairs for nice weather and there's a kettle for colder weather. There are bags of fertilizer and mulch along one wall. These are bought from the kitty and Carlito carries them in whenever the minibus comes back from the garden center. Pinned above the fertilizer are the rules of the Cooper's Chase Allotment Users Association. They are lengthy and they are enforced with vigor. It is cold, even on a summer's night. The torch continues its circuit. There are no windows, which makes it easier. The spade rests against the back wall inside the shed. One look tells him all he needs to know. All he already knew, if he was honest, as he walked up the path. But what to do? You have to try. He lifts it by the handle, but is quickly beaten by its weight. When did he get so weak? What happened to his body? It was never much to write home about. But to think he could now barely lift a spade? Digging was out of the question. So what now? Who could help? Who would understand? It was hopeless. Bernard Cottle sits in a folding chair and weeps for what he has done. Chapter 84. Chris and Donna are sitting in the jigsaw room, with mugs of tea. Opposite them are Jason Ritchie and Bobby Tanner. Bobby Tanner, whom detectives across eight forces had failed to locate. Elizabeth has repeatedly refused to say where or how she found him. Elizabeth and Joyce have both seen evidence that Bobby was busy elsewhere when Tony Curran was murdered. Chris had wondered if he might see that evidence and Elizabeth had told him he certainly could, the moment he produced a warrant. Bobby's deal was that he would tell them everything he knew and then slip back into the crowd, never to be seen again. $100,000, bit more than that, says Bobby Tanner. Johnny had it at his flat, used to keep it safe for Tony. Did he have a nice flat? Asks Joyce. One of the big ones on the front, says Bobby. Oh yes, with the picture windows, says Joyce. Lovely. And Tony went out to Cyprus looking for him, asks Chris. A couple of times, yeah. Never found a thing. Nothing was the same after that. Jason, you drifted off, didn't you? Started doing telly and all that. Jason nods. It wasn't for me anymore, Bobby. Bobby nods. I left town a couple of months after, when my brother died. Nothing left for me here then. But someone would have seen Johnny, surely, asks Donna. If he'd come back to town recently? Someone would have seen him, someone would be talking. Bobby thinks about this. Not too many faces left from those days. Hard to know who Johnny would turn to if he needed a place to stay, says Jason. Bobby looks at Jason. Unless, Jace. Jason looks back at Bobby, thinks for a moment, then nods. Of course, of course. Unless, Jason starts composing a text. Are you going to share this with the group? Asks Elizabeth. Just someone me and Bobby need to talk to, says Jason. Someone who'd know for sure. Leave it with us. It's not fair if you get to solve everything, Elizabeth. Perhaps you could share it with the police, suggests Donna. Oh come on, says Bobby, laughing. Worth a try, says Donna. Jason's phone pings. He looks down, then turns to Bobby. He can meet us at 2. That okay for you? Bobby nods and Jason starts another message. Only one place for it, at. Chapter 85. Lunch at Le Pont Noir. Just like old times and yet, of course, not like them at all. Astronaut, guesses Jason Ritchie. Bobby Tanner smiles, and shakes his head. Jockey, guesses Jason. Bobby Tanner shakes his head again. I ain't gonna tell you, even if you guess. Fair enough, fair enough. You happy though, Bobby? Asks Jason. Bobby nods his head. Good lad, says Jason. You deserve it. We both do, agrees Bobby Tanner. One way or another. Well, we do and we don't, says Jason. Bobby Tanner nods. Maybe so. They are on desserts, still waiting for their guest, and a bottle of Le Pont Noir's finest Malbec has been dispatched. I mean, it must have been Johnny, right? Asks Bobby. I've always thought he was dead somewhere. I've always thought that you were dead somewhere, says Jason. I'm glad you're not though. Thanks, Jace, says Bobby. Jason looks at his watch. We'll know for sure soon enough. You reckon he'll know? Asks Bobby. If Gianni's been over, then he'll know. That's where he'd have stayed. I can't do lunchtime drinking anymore, can you? Asks Bobby. We're old men now, Bob, agrees Jason. Time for another bottle though. They agree that they do have time for another bottle. And then in walks Steve Georgiou. Chapter 86. Donna has spent the evening looking through airplane passenger lists to and from Cyprus for the last 2 weeks. As if Johnny Gundas would be using his own name these days. But you never knew. Fun though the passenger lists had been, however, Donna is now back on Instagram. Toyota was history already, but Carl wouldn't wait around. Who was he seeing now? Donna was nothing if not a natural detective. Was he seeing that woman from his work, Poppy? Poppy, whose photo he'd liked on Facebook. Not just liked, but replied to with a wink emoji. Poppy, who seemed incapable of having her photo taken without being shot from the left and pouting. Yes, she was obvious enough for Carl. Donna had run her name through the home office computer on the off chance, but nothing. Donna knows it is time for bed, but she is still thinking about Penny Gray. After the Thursday Murder Club meeting, Elizabeth had told her she wanted her to meet someone and had led her into Willows, the nursing home attached to Cooper's Chase. They had walked down quiet beige corridors, with dim strip lighting and seaside watercolors lining the walls. It all carried an appalling weight, and the hopeful sprigs of flowers on cheap MDF side tables were powerless against it. Who brought the flowers in every day? That was a losing battle, but what was the alternative? Donna had gulped for air at one point. Willows was a prison from which no escape was possible. Where release could mean only one thing. They had walked into the room and Elizabeth had said, "Constable De Freitas, I'd like you to meet Detective Inspector Penny Gray." Penny had been lying in bed, a light sheet covering her to the neck, a blanket further down, folded back. Tubes running from her nose and from her wrists. Donna had once been on a school trip to the Lloyd's building, where everything that should be on the inside was on the outside. She preferred everything tidied away. Donna saluted. "Ma'am. Take a seat, Donna, I thought it would be nice for the two of you to get to know each other. I do think you'll get along." Elizabeth had taken Donna through Penny's career. Smart, resilient, opinionated, thwarted at every turn, by her gender and by her temperament. Or rather by the unacceptable combination of them both. "She's a wrecking ball," Elizabeth had said. "I'm a thin blade, you understand. Penny is all brute force. I don't know if you could tell that now." Donna looked at Penny and fancied that she could. It was fashionable in the police back then, Elizabeth had gone on. A bit of blunt force. Fashionable if you were a man at least, it never helped Penny, she never made it higher than Detective Inspector. Absurd if you knew her. "I'm right, John, absurd, wasn't it?" John had looked up and nodded. "A waste. She was trouble, Donna," said Elizabeth. "And I can think of no finer compliment. That's why Penny enjoyed looking over the old cases. She could finally be in charge. Could finally be the bull in a china shop. She didn't have to be polite and laugh at the jokes and make the tea." Donna saw Elizabeth's hand close around Penny's. Elizabeth looked at her and nodded. "We fight on though, do we not?" Penny took it all, sucked it up, as they say, day after day, without complaint. She complained a lot. This was John. "With respect, Elizabeth." Well, yes, she had an impressive temper on her when she wanted to. Very focused, John had agreed. As they had left, generations apart, but shoulder to shoulder and in perfect step, Elizabeth had turned to Donna and said, "You will know better than me, Donna, but I think perhaps not all the battles have been won." "I think perhaps too," Donna had agreed. They had continued, in companionable silence, out through the front doors of Willows, grateful to be breathing the air of the outside world. Back at home, was this really home now? Donna is not fully concentrating on Instagram anymore. The visit to Penny has made her proud and sad. She would love to have met her. Really met her. There are many reasons why Donna would like to be the one to crack these murders, and she adds making Detective Inspector Penny Gray proud to her list. Johnny for the Tony Curran murder? Matthew Mackey for Ventham? Elizabeth had told her to look into another of the residents. A Bernard Cottle. She had written the name down. And the bones. Are they important? What do you say, Penny Gray? It would be nice to wrap it all up. A nice tribute to someone who has gone before. She should get back to those passenger lists. Donna scrolls through some final pictures. Poppy has just been bungee jumping for cancer research. Well, of course she has, that was so Poppy. Chapter 87. Joyce, I don't often write in the morning, I know. But today I am. I just felt I should. So here I am. Yesterday was all very interesting, wasn't it? Those boys and all the murders and the drugs and what have you. I bet they had a lot to talk about when they headed off afterwards. I wonder who they were meeting? Really, it was very interesting to someone like me. Very interesting. Johnny certainly sounds a likely culprit, doesn't he? I wonder if... Oh, stop it, Joyce, just stop it. You're putting it off. You don't want to write it? All right then. So I have had some sad news, and the sad news is this. I made my All's Well call to Bernard this morning. Lots of people have an All's Well arrangement. You buddy up with a pal, ring them at 8 a.m., let it ring twice and put the phone down. Then they do the same back. So you each know the other is okay without it costing you a penny. And, of course, you don't have to have a conversation. So I rang Bernard this morning. Two rings, letting him know I was safe and sound, hadn't had a fall or what have you. But nothing back. I never worry too much, sometimes he forgets and I wander round and ring his buzzer and he shuffles to the window in his dressing gown and gives me a guilty thumbs up. I always think, oh let me in, you silly old man, let's have some breakfast, I don't mind the dressing gown, but that's not Bernard. So over I trotted. Did I know? I suppose I did, but I also didn't, because it's too big a thing to know. But I suppose I did know, because Marjorie Walters saw me on my way over, and said she'd waved but I hadn't seen, just lost in a world of my own, which isn't like me. So, yes, I suppose I knew. I buzzed and looked up at the window. The curtains were drawn. Perhaps he was asleep? Had a touch of flu and stayed in bed. Man flu, someone had said on this morning the other day. It had tickled me and I'd told Joanna, but she said the expression had been around for years and had I really never heard it? Which put me in my place. I'm stalling, I know. Let's get onto it. I let myself into the block with the spare key fob, I walked up the flight of stairs and saw an envelope sellotaped to Bernard's door. On the front of it he had written Joyce. Sorry, I have to finish there. There was even a smiley face in the O. You really never knew with Bernard. Chapter 88. Joyce opens up the envelope and slips out a handwritten letter. Maybe 3 or 4 pages. She is grateful that her friends have come to her flat. She didn't want to go out there again today. So, I'll just read it. Not all of it, but the bits of interest. It answers a few questions we had. I know what some of you had been thinking about him. Maybe thought he'd, you know. Ian Ventham. Anyway. You take your time, says Ron, and places his hand on Joyce's for a moment. Joyce begins to read, with an unfamiliar waver. Dear Joyce, I am sorry for the nuisance. Don't try to come in, I have bolted the door. First time I have used that bolt since I moved here. You will know what I have done, and I suppose it's nothing you haven't seen before 1,000 times. I will be lying on the bed, all things being well, and perhaps I will look peaceful, but perhaps I won't. I would rather not take that chance, so I'll leave it to the ambulance men to decide if I look in a fit state for you to say goodbye. That is if you wish to say goodbye. Joyce stops reading for a moment. Elizabeth, Ron, and Ibrahim are completely silent. She looks up at them. They didn't let me see him in the end. I'm sure that's policy, when you're not family. So he got that bit wrong, didn't he? And they were both ambulance women. Joyce gives a weak smile and her three friends mirror it. She continues reading. I have the pills by my side and I have a Lafroig I had been saving for a rainy day. I see the lights turning off around me and it will be my turn next. Next to the bed are the beautiful flowers you bought me. They are in a milk bottle, because you know me and vases. But before I go, I suppose I should tell you the whole thing. The whole thing, says Elizabeth. Joyce puts a finger to her lips. Elizabeth does as she is told and Joyce continues reading Bernard's final letter. As you know, Asima, that's his wife, died shortly after we moved to Cooper's Chase, which was a spanner in the works. I know you don't talk about Gary very much, Joyce, but I know you understand. Like someone reached in and took out my heart and my lungs and told me to keep living. Keep waking up, keep eating, keep putting one foot in front of the other. For what? I don't think I ever really found an answer to that. You know, I would often walk up the hill and sit on the bench Isima and I used to sit on when we first moved here, and you know I felt close to her there. But I had another reason for climbing that hill, a reason for which I feel profound shame. A shame that has become too much for me to bear. Joyce pauses for a moment. I wonder if I might have some water. Ron pours her a glass and hands it to her. Joyce drinks, then returns to the letter. You will know that many Hindus have their ashes scattered on the Ganges. These days, other rivers will do, but for a certain generation it's still the Ganges, if you have the wherewithal. This was Asima's wish many, many years ago, certainly a wish that our daughter Sufi had grown up hearing about. Asima's funeral is not something I wish to think about or write about, but 2 days afterwards Sufi and Majid, that's the daughter and son-in-law, flew to Varanasi in India and scattered Asima's ashes on the Ganges. But Joyce, and here's where the pills and the whiskey come in, I'm afraid, they weren't her ashes. She pauses and looks up. Well. Goodness, says Ibrahim, and sits forward as Joyce reads on. I am not a religious man, Joyce, as you are aware. But in her later years, Asima was not a religious woman either. She shook off her faith slowly, like the leaves from a tree, until nothing remained. I loved that woman with everything I possess and she loved me. The thought of her leaving, being placed in hand luggage, Joyce, and then floating away from me. Well, that wasn't something I was able to comprehend 2 days after saying goodbye. None of this excuses my actions, but I hope it might explain them. I had the ashes at home, for the first night. Sufi and Majid weren't in my spare room, they had preferred to stay in a hotel, despite it all. Many years ago Asima and I had been browsing at an old antique shop and she had picked up a tea caddy in the shape of a tiger. Well, that's you, I said, and we both laughed. I called her Little Tiger and she called me Big Tiger, you know the drill. I went back a week later to buy it for her, as a surprise Christmas present, but it had already been sold. Anyway, that Christmas, I opened my present from her, and there it was. She had obviously gone straight back and bought it for me. I have kept it ever since. So, I took the urn and poured the ashes from the urn into the tiger tea caddy, then placed the caddy back in the cupboard. I filled the urn with a mixture of sawdust and bone meal, it's surprisingly convincing, then sealed it shut again. And that's what Sufi took to Varanasi and that's what she scattered on the Ganges. Bear in mind I wasn't thinking straight, Joyce, I was paralyzed with grief. I would have done anything to stop my Asima floating away. I had forgotten, of course, that she was Sufi's Asima too. The next day, as soon after dark as I dared, I took a spade from the allotment shed and walked up the hill. I cut the turf from underneath the bench, I dug a hole and I buried the tin. Even then I knew it could only be temporary, but I wasn't ready to let her go. The turf settled back in, nobody ever noticed a thing, why would they? And every day I would go and sit on the bench, say hello when people walked by and talk to Asima when they didn't. I knew then that it was wrong, I knew that I had betrayed my daughter and that I could never make amends. But the pain was so very great. Some people love their children more than they love their partner, says Ibrahim, and some people love their partner more than their children. And no one can ever admit to either thing. Joyce nods, absent-mindedly and begins a new page. The immediate pain goes, however much you might want it to stay, and I soon came to understand the enormity of what I had done. The awful selfishness, the entitlement. I started to think of plans and plots, something to put it right. Maybe I would dig the tea caddy up, I would take it on the bus down to Fairhaven, let some of her go and keep some of her with me. I could never tell Sufi what I had done, but at least her mother would be in the waves, returning to wherever Sufi imagines we return to. I knew it wasn't enough, but it was the best I could do. Until one morning I climbed the hill to find workmen laying a concrete foundation for the bench. They had dug down, not far enough to find the tin, and filled the hole with cement. They had the job done in half an hour. And that was that, I suppose, so silly when you look at it, but I had no easy way of digging the tea caddy back up. So I would continue to walk up the hill and continue to talk to Asima when no one was listening, telling her my news, telling her how much I loved her and telling her I was sorry. And honestly, Joyce, for your eyes only, I realize that I have run out of whatever it is that we need to carry on. So that's me, I'm afraid. Joyce, finishes, stares down at the letter for another moment, running a finger across the ink. She looks up at her friends and attempts a smile, which turns, in an instant, to tears. The tears turn to shaking sobs and Ron leaves his chair, kneels in front of her and takes her in his arms. The thing Ron is so good at. Joyce buries her head in Ron's shoulder and flings her arms around him, weeping for Gary and for Bernard and for Asima and for the ladies who went to Jersey Boys and drank GNTS out of cans all the way home. Chapter 89. It is too late to be in Fairhaven Police Station, but Donna and Chris have nowhere else to be. Chris kneels and unblocks the paper jam in the photocopier. Chris finds it hard to kneel without cramping up these days. He isn't sure what that is. Too much salt, or not enough salt. It's one or the other. Fixed it, he tells Donna. Donna presses print and makes a series of copies of the reports she's been sent by the Cypriot Police Service. I'll bind them all together for you, says Donna. It'll take a while, but it'll be easier for you. Very kind, Donna, says Chris. But you're still not coming to Cyprus with me. Donna sticks out her tongue. Chris has a very interesting interview lined up. One that should tell them once and for all where Johnny Gundas is. Gianni's name has not appeared on any of the passenger lists that Donna had waded through. No flight, no boat, no train, either into or out of the UK. But Chris supposes that Johnny is unlikely to still be using his old name. Not when the police had been hunting him down for the murder of the young cabbie and Tony Curran had been hunting him down for the £100,000 he had stolen. But no one could simply disappear. There would be a trace somewhere. Chris shuts down his computer. He feels sure that Turkish Johnny is their man, he's been around long enough to sense when something fits perfectly. Evidence was another thing, but hopefully the trip to Nicosia will help him out there. Shall we call it a night? Quick drink, says Donna. Pont Noir. 6:50 flight in the morning, says Chris. Don't rub it in, says Donna. Chris stands and pulls down his office blinds. Johnny was one thing, but Ian Ventham? That was harder. Was it really connected to a murder from 50 years ago? Surely not. How many people could there be? Chris even had two disc tracking down nuns in case they could remember anything. Surely some of them had left at some point? Lost their calling and gone out into the real world? What would they be now? 80-odd. Records were sketchy though, and he held out little hope. Or were they all missing something simpler? Don't crack the case while I'm gone, please. I can't promise anything, says Donna. Chris picks up his briefcase. Time to go home. Always the worst time. Chris's dream life remains just one stone away. But in his briefcase there is a packet of salt and vinegar McCoy's, a Whispa, and a Diet Coke. Diet Coke. Who did Chris think he was kidding? Sometimes Chris thinks he should join a dating website. In his mind his perfect date would be a divorced teacher who had a small dog and sang in a choir. But he'd be happy to be proved wrong. Just someone kind and funny really. Chris holds the door open for Donna, then follows her out. What kind of woman would want Chris? Did women really mind a bit of extra timber these days? Well, yes, he was sure they did, but even so. He was just about to solve a murder, and surely, somewhere in the whole of Kent, there was someone who might find that attractive. Chapter 90. Joyce, oh, I can't sleep. It's Bernard, 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 of course. I'm already wondering about the funeral. Will it be here? I do hope so. I know I hadn't known him long, but I'd hate to think of him in Vancouver. So I'm back here at 2 in the morning, to give you some news. Don't worry, no one has died this time. After Ian, we had all been wondering what's to become of us here at Cooper's Chase. Who was going to take it over? I don't think anyone was too concerned, it seems to be profitable enough, so we knew there would be takers. But who? You can probably guess who found out. Elizabeth accidentally bumped into Gemma Ventham, Ian Ventham's unfortunate widow, yesterday, at the new deli they've opened in Roberts Bridge. It used to be Claire's hairdresser's, until Claire was struck off. Is struck off the correct expression for hairdressers? Either way, the local GP's wife lost the top of an ear, and that was that. They say Claire's in Brighton now, and that's probably for the best. Gemma was with a man, who Elizabeth described as a tennis coach type, though conceded that these days he might have been a Pilates instructor type. Certainly not a grieving widow, and I think we all agreed that she'd earned a bit of happiness, so good for her. She has also, it seems, earned an awful lot of money. This is what Elizabeth got out of her. I don't know exactly how, but I do know that at one point she had pretended to faint, because she had actually grazed her elbow in the effort. She always finds a way, that one. Anyway, Gemma Ventham has sold Cooper's Chase Holdings to a company called Bramley Holdings. Of course, we've tried to find out as much as we can about Bramley Holdings, but thus far, no luck. We even called in Joanna and Cornelius, but they've turned up a blank. They promised they would keep looking, although you can hear that Cornelius's patience is beginning to wear a bit thin. But here's something else keeping me awake. That name. Bramley Holdings. It is ringing a bell and I can't work out why. Elizabeth says they take names off the shelf, and perhaps she is right, but an alarm is ringing in my brain and I can't switch it off. Bramley. Where have I heard that before? And I know I'm an old woman, but don't say apples. Something else. Something important. Anne, who edits Cut to the Chase, came to see me today. People will always come and see you when you lose a friend. By now we've all worked out the right things to say. We've said them often enough. I don't think she is doing it just to be nice, but Anne has asked if I will write a column in Cut to the Chase. She knows I like to write and she knows I have my nose in everything, so would I write something about the comings and goings at Cooper's Chase? I said yes, of course, and we are going to call it Joyce's Choices, which I like. I had suggested Joyce's Voices, but Anne had thought that might sound a bit mental health. She wants a picture of me, so I will go through a few tomorrow and pick out a nice one. We are off to see Gordon Playfair tomorrow as well. The farmer at the top of the hill? He's the only person any of us can think of who was here in the early 1970s and is still here today. He was nowhere near Ventham when he was murdered, so I don't think we can count him as a suspect, but we're hoping he might remember something useful from all those years ago. I must try and sleep again.